Everybody, this is Pam, and you're listening to the podcast Women Who Stutter Our Stories, which can be found on the blog Make Room for the Stuttering at stutterrockstar.com, and it's also freely available as a download on iTunes. Today I have the opportunity and real privilege to have another amazing woman on the show today, so I'd like to say hello to Leslie. Hey, how are you doing today?
Hiya, Pam. I'm fine, thank you.
Great. I'm so excited to have you on the show today. To get us started, could you tell us who you are, where you're from, and what keeps you busy?
Okay. My name's Leslie Brownlow. I'm from Liverpool in the UK. Where I used to live in Liverpool was about half a mile away from where the Beatles are from. I'm 53. I'm divorced. I work for a local council, a local council run adult education service. I average in between 36 to 40 hours a week. Keeps me very busy. And in that, I do like an exams officer role, engagements, new courses, meeting new learners. And it's very busy, very productive, very stressful, especially after the interesting year that we've had. But we won't go there just yet. At the moment I live alone. My children are 22 and 20. The elder, my daughter lives in London, lives and works in London as a research assistant and a living nanny.
Oh.
The younger is my son, studying aeronautical engineering in Glasgow University. So one's in Scotland, one's in London. But I keep myself really busy, like at home. I've got interesting hobbies, and once restrictions start to lift up a bit more, I'll be able to actually meet up with some friends again.
Because
I like going walking, going swimming again, and I read a lot as well. So,
You do have a lot to keep you busy. What got you interested in adult education? Why did you choose that career?
It was, I've got to be honest, it probably chose me.
Okay.
It was never a definitive career choice, because back when I was a child, all I wanted to do was be a writer. It was a bit of a disappointment to realise you actually have to write and you have to work hard, and you need to earn money before you can actually you can't just sit at a typewriter and write books and stories. So after university, I was working at a local school, working in the office, and I just I'd never seen no to opportunities and a challenge. So it was like, oh, I can do that. Yeah, I'll do that. Extra responsibility, I'll do that. That looks interesting. So it was kind of I just started off administration, then it was coordinating, and then it was actually managing the adult education provision within the school, and then I went into the council properly. So, and with each year. I've now been working in education for, oh God, far too long. 23. I actually started working in the school, in a little school, you know, comprehensive school or high school in your system. Yeah. And then, as I say, I just moved around and ended up, you know, in a really good job, you know, with Knowsley Council. So, and it's I work with nice people, but I like it, you see, you know. So you
stay where you like it, because that's familiar grounds for us, right?
It's familiar ground. That's spot on there, yeah.
So I was wondering, you know, when you chose adult education, there's a lot of communication and meeting with people either one-on-one or in groups, many people who stammer won't do that because of their stammering. So, you know, how do you manage that with students, with colleagues?
It's an interesting question, and one that I think I was expecting, but it's still not a prepared answer. It's when you said that it's a kind of field where those who stammer might not actually go into it because it's so communication driven. Curiously, that was one of the reasons why I wanted to go into it. As I said before, it was a challenge. Mm-hmm. And basically I wanted to book the stereotype.
Mm-hmm.
And also one of the things that I mentioned with a speech and language therapist yesterday was people think the communication skills is all about talking, just production of speech, saying something, you communicate a thought and that's all it is. But it's not just the mechanism of speech. It's,
right.
It's engaging someone, including them, entertaining them, challenging them if necessary,
mm-hmm.
In as gentle as a kind way and supportive way. And that's what communication skills is about. Mm-hmm. It's not just about speaking. I mean, we know many fluent people who are very poor communicators.
Absolutely.
I'm sure you do. I do.
Yes.
Fluent people, you know, so they don't necessarily go together. And so when I'm working with learners and colleagues, for the most part, they just accept me anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And with learners, back in the day when I first started doing it, I used to be intimidated by, not intimidated in the frightened sense by learners, but I was uncertain if I started stammering when I'm in a position of power, of authority. I'm supposed to be a teacher type, as opposed to I don't want them to think I don't know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really shy of stuttering, but because I didn't want to stutter, it came across as more anxious.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, oh, they may wonder why I'm being anxious. Mm-hmm. So I got myself into a little kind of tizzy, you know, like a little cycle. And then I just thought, I might as well just stammer openly with the learners.
Mm-hmm.
If I feel they're uncomfortable with the stammer, I say, I've got a stammer. It's like a disability. It's like having dyslexia.
Mm-hmm.
And then they think, oh God, I've got dyslexia, that's fun. And it's just like it completely kind of levels out. I'm working in the field of education, but all that means is what you provide the services through mm-hmm. which that you can actually learn a new skill.
Right.
So, I mean, I've got lots of skills, there's things I can't do. So I would go to another education provider to learn how to do other skills. And it was once I got those together, the idea that you can communicate, you can stammer, you can learn a new skill, I was able to deal with learners on an equal level. Mm-hmm. And with colleagues, they're all absolutely fine. They found me entertaining, they found me irritating, and you know, but we work together.
Do you ever disclose to people when you first meet them that you do stutter?
If I feel a need to, frequently I don't, but it'll depend on the circumstances, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes if I've introduced myself and say, my name's Leslie Brownlow, it's obvious that I've got a stutter. Mm-hmm. So I don't, especially if it's face-to-face. If I'm on the phone, however, and I feel a bit nervous here, I think I'm going to disclose that I've got a stutter. And as soon as I do that, that relaxes me. They understand why there may be a silence or a pause, and people are usually okay about it.
Yeah.
So I think disclosing the got a stutter actually helps immeasurably. It really does.
Yeah. It lessens our anxiety. So therefore, it lessens the listener's anxiety as well. And I liked what you said earlier about communication is so much more than, talking and what comes out of our mouth. It includes eye contact and body language and all of that stuff. Yeah. But let me ask you this. Do you feel that there is more intimacy involved in the communication encounter when one stutters and one doesn't, if that makes sense?
You mean, actually, I'm not quite sure. Do you know what you mean? Do you want to clarify that a little bit further?
Yeah, so like if I am talking with somebody that does not stutter, and it's it's an important conversation, I think that when I am being vulnerable, that person may feel like they can then share something about themselves. And that encounter becomes more intimate because you've, by default, shared something very personal about yourself.
I think that you're spot on there. And I think that that's in line with one of my theories about authenticity. If you're authentic and you're vulnerable in the sense that you've made it obvious that you've got a stutter, then you're right, you can have more real relationships. They know that you're not putting on an image, pretending to be something that you're not.
Right.
You've got a stutter, it's part of you, and you're owning it. And I think, as you know, that you're more likely to have better relationships in that sense, more intimate relationships in that sense. And I think that's really interesting. I like that.
Yeah. And plus, when we're speaking with a communication partner, and they realize that we stutter, either because we've told them or it's obvious, they then become more present, and that I think is like the foundation of building a relationship, when there's presence,
Yes. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. I feel that present relationship when the person is just actively listening, maintaining eye contact, not trying to finish my sentences, Does that make sense for you?
It makes total sense. I mean, one of the things when we, what you talk about as stuttering is that we don't want them to finish off our sentences. And we want them to actively listen.
Right.
And they're more likely to lean, to lean forward, to be more engaged within the conversation.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that you said something yesterday to your speech and language therapist. So I'm curious, You mentioned your age.
Yeah.
Why are you in speech therapy at this at this juncture in your life?
I think the word therapy is a little bit misleading.
Okay.
It's not, in my eyes, it is therapy, but in my eyes, it's more of a supportive relationship than it is technically therapy.
Okay.
It's speech therapy, but it's more it's more of a support mechanism that that's in place. Mm-hmm. Merseyside's very good in the fact that there's got the older hay. Hospital Trust, which has got the really Russell Centre with it, which specialises in speech and language therapy for adults and for children, mm-hmm. and mainly for children, but also for adults as well. And I self-referred a couple of years ago, and I found it so helpful to just actually meet. I should meet other adults who stutter, because mm-hmm. one of the things that's the best part of speech and language therapy as an adult is the knowledge that there's other adults out there who stutter who've achieved high status in their, you know, their world of employment. Mm-hmm. The psychiatrists, there's project managers, there's doctors, there's computer managers, these are successful people
mm-hmm.
who just happen to stutter,
mm-hmm.
and it's encouraging them to get out there and say, this is what I can do. The president of the United States of America is a man who stutters.
You know
you can't get more, you know, you can reach the highest that you can possibly reach
mm-hmm.
as a person who stutters, as an adult who stutters, mm-hmm. and it's encouraging to meet those other adults who've achieved these levels and to show the others who are less experienced or like a different rung of their professional status, if you like. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they've done it. I can do it. it's that, and it's mixing with other adults who stammer that helps that actual process.
Yeah, that knowledge that there's other people out there that are leading successful lives, that kind of busts the myth, right?
It certainly does. Like
when I was younger, growing up, I had built in my head, I can't do this or I can't do that because I stutter. So I have to find a job that every job requires communication.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. Now, have you always been this open about your stuttering?
No. Okay, that was a short answer. when I was, my ability to disclose confidently the fact that a stutter has wavered over the years with my professional life, personal life. And I think I don't want to talk about stuttering this year. And so it's, as I say, it's waved, gone in waves. But I didn't talk about it prior to 2011. Or didn't talk about it very much. The people who I worked with, they knew that I stuttered because it's obvious. Mm-hmm. But we didn't really speak about it. This is as a working adult. When I was a child, it was different. But as a working adult, I didn't want to talk about it. It was the elephant in the room syndrome. Mm-hmm. if I don't talk about it, it's not obvious, they're not going to ask me. And of course, it, but all that it resulted in, you know, was what they call covert stuttering. And which you know what that means. It's when you avoid situations, you avoid words, you become highly skilled at switching sentences around, you say things that are a bit strange.
Yeah.
Because you don't really want to say, because you say things that you wouldn't normally say, mm-hmm. simply because you can say it fluently. Mm-hmm. And the amount of times I had people frowning thinking, I don't really understand what that means. And I'd have to, and they asked, would you repeat it? And I'm thinking, and I'm getting myself up in knots to say it again in a different way. Mm-hmm. Trying to be fluent. And it didn't work. And then there was a stage, as I say, in 2010. I don't know what was going on in work at the time, but I just decided that I want to talk about, no. It was the King's Speech, wasn't it? Colin Firth,
yes,
film.
Yes.
It was that year. Went to see it with my mum, and I thought, stammering. I went onto the internet, looked up stammering, and the following year, I went to my first BSA stammering conference, and it just blew my mind. And I just thought, I want to talk about this. I've struggled for the past 7 to 10 years in work and personally with not being able to talk about it. And so the following 10 years I've actually gone up and up as regards that. Mm-hmm. And talking about stammering is probably the most important therapy mm-hmm. for anyone who stammers.
Yeah, and it meeting really other is. People, right? Meeting other people.
Stammer. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So what Definitely. Gave you the confidence yeah. to go to that BSA conference? What changed? What allowed yourself to say, I wanna go to this?
I think I was just fed up. It was just, I want another challenge. I just wanna, yeah, I wanna meet other people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was in the, it was the year before that my marriage dissolved. So I think that had something to do with it as well. Mm-hmm. But it was, as I say, I was fed up with talking about what I wanted to talk about. Mm-hmm. And watching that film, that was literally a life changer, watching that film. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, if it's suddenly out there, you know, it's probably always been out there in one form or other, mm-hmm. but actually watching a film about it and the opening scenes of the King's Speech, if you remember, actually standing there in front of this almighty microphone,
mm-hmm.
and he's clearly struggling to speak in front of, and it thought, and this microphone, you know, that's a symbol of communication. I mean, in those days, you know, mm-hmm. it was radio communication, and that's how the scene opens. Is this, there's the, you know, this microphone that the King of England's about to give a speech, mm-hmm. and he can't.
Mm-hmm.
That was a really powerful symbol, and I thought, that for me, if he can do it, and you know it's out there now, he made that fantastic film, and I thought, yeah, that's for me now as well.
yeah, that was very powerful. I went to see it. I went to see it the first time myself, and then because I had never talked about stuttering growing up. You know, and I was trying to, I also had the elephant in the room, but was like blown away when my mom and one of my sisters said they'd like to go see it too. And I'm like, oh my God, like it was the first time somebody had acknowledged that. So you know, I said, sure. So I went with them, which made it my second time. And I was trying so hard not to cry and not have them hear me crying. So that was good. It was a good tipping point, I think, for people. Now, before you went to that conference, had you met any other women who stutter?
Glad you asked that as well, because I've got a little anecdote around that as well. When I was at university, I met a young lady, a similar age to me. I don't know if she was a year older than me, with a severe stammer. And I'm ashamed to say I avoided her like the plague. She was, other than the speech therapy that I'd had when I was 13 with other boys, I'd never met a woman who stammered before. I knew boys did because it's been on the news and television programs, etc. But I'd never met another woman who stammered. And as I said, I didn't. It was like seeing a version of me I didn't like. And as I say, I'm ashamed to say. And if I ever met that woman, a perfectly nice woman, as I say, and I thought that could have been a relationship made in heaven, you know. And as I didn't want anything to do with her. So if she's out there, wherever you are, I am very, very, very sorry.
You know, I had a similar experience. And in my head, I thought, oh my God, thank God I don't sound that bad. You know,
I think I said that as well.
You know, and then I thought to myself in horror, well, I stutter and she stutters. Why would I think that? And I felt so guilty, you know, and then
I felt awful afterwards.
I did too. And at the end of the event that I was at, I went up to her and I told her, you know, very honestly, you know, I felt guilty when I thought this thought about you. And she and I are great friends now because
I wish I had that chance, but no.
Honest with her and tell her that at first I wanted nothing to do with that because I was afraid, you know?
It didn't help with me, as I say, you know, because I was at that age, you know. As like a young woman away from home for the first time, I actually embraced the university scene, and but only certain people. And a couple of years later, when I thought about it, I thought, God, the shallowness of youth. You know, it was just, it was just, you know. It's not nice to be that age and to realize that you don't accept certain things. And you know, it wasn't nice. I've learned from that.
I learned from my lesson too, you know, that first of all, what I learned was everybody stutters differently. And when I hear somebody stutter, I'm not looking in the mirror. They don't reflect back to me because we stutter differently. That's what makes stuttering so complex, right? Because it is so variable.
Definitely.
What's it been like with your children? Have they always been supportive of mom that stutters?
In the sense that they support me, like, anyway. I mean, as far as they're concerned, their mum's always been there. Their mum's always had a stutter, and they don't hear the stutter. It's just part of mum. The fact now, their mum's 5'3" with blue eyes, and she's got a stutter. As regards supportive, I don't think my children would use the word supportive, but not that they're unsupportive. It's just the fact that they've always been there, and you know, go for it, mum, do that, mum, you know, why don't you do that? And that, but But that's all, isn't it?
Yeah.
But they are very, very good.
Yeah, yeah. And children are so more accepting, right, and resilient than adults are. I have found adults have been ruder to me than children ever have. You know?
Yeah, I think.
So switching gears, tell me about your writing and what drew you there.
Okay. When I was 4 and 5, I realised that I spoke differently. It was never really an issue, although with speech therapy, they were apparently at a very young age. I didn't know I did, but I was told. But I realised I spoke differently, and I read a lot. No, I was a quiet, solitary child, reasonably confident, but I was just, you know, actually doing things on my own. And so when I started reading, I thought, I actually like reading about worlds, but I want to make some of my own new worlds. And so I started writing short stories when I was about 6 or 7. Mm-hmm. And I've never really stopped.
Mm-hmm.
I would hope I'm better than I was when I was a 7-year-old writer.
Yeah.
Back in those days, it was stories that probably alarmingly resembled Enid Blyton. Mm. And there was a series of pony book writers who used to read, and they used to replicate them. Mm. And then I progressed on to romantic stories. And then by the time I was 12, I was writing Stephen King type stuff before I'd ever read even any Stephen King.
Mm-hmm.
So I was writing about astral projections and sinister friendships. They were the age of 12 and 13. I didn't know what they meant.
Mm-hmm.
So it was in last year or the year before, I was sorting out some old papers and stuff the way you do every now and again. Yeah, you actually have a declutter. And I found some old stories that I'd written.
Mm.
And sure enough, there was one of these stories about this very strange young woman who set fire to her ex-husband's house.
Gosh.
And I was 15 years old.
Wow.
I was a child, you know. And I think, oh, strange child. But there was a happy ending. So I'd obviously progressed, which from the romantic, this early adolescence to more mysterious type. And then I stopped writing for a while because obviously I was at university.
Mm-hmm.
And then started again late 20s, 30s. And I've never really stopped. And now this sounds funny, but I'm going to say anyway, I've written 4 novels.
Mm-hmm.
Two of them are completed ones, and the other two are yet to be completed.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm working on. They're like it's like a set of four. Okay, it was going to be a trilogy, but number 4 goes back to where it all started, and it kind of wraps up the circle.
Mm-hmm.
So the character in book 1, we go back in book 4, we go back to his childhood and beyond. When I first started, it was only ever going to be one. And then because I liked the idea of the story arc, just, you know, actually carried on with one, but didn't finish the second. The reason why I didn't finish off the second, but I just started the third one.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, and I think it'd be interesting to see, you know, what's actually. So I just think, with the symmetry behind, number 1 finished, number 2 unfinished, 3 finished, and then number 4 unfinished.
Yeah.
But it's But I like writing. And as I say, even if I don't ever get them published, I'd still carry on writing. As I say, it's a way of escaping into a world where I can invent people. Incidentally, one of the characters in novel four is a woman who stammers.
You know, the reason I'm interested in hearing people talk about writing is that oftentimes I've heard people get into writing because they think that can be their fluent voice. So like they compensate for, you know, not being able to speak, you know, fluently, which of course is, you know, something that takes up headspace, but that they're better writing. And I've heard people say, I'd rather write than talk because I don't stutter then.
Totally agree with that.
Yeah.
And it is. And I met her when she is the Welsh writer the year before last at the last conference in Cardiff. And the presentation that he did, that's exactly what they would refer to. They read his favourite authors, Thomas Hardy and Yeats were in there as well. And he said he wanted to go away and actually write perfect worlds fluently. because in my head, I'm fluent.
Yeah.
I think that's what, you know, he's in my head, I'm fluent and I can write fluently.
Yeah.
Lovely
yeah.
man. Yeah.
Yeah, because we get this imaginary thought in our head, and I don't know about you, but for quite a long time, stuttering took up so much headspace of mine, and I was always thinking about it, and always trying to, you know, figure out what are they gonna think of me, and you know, I'm so glad I don't do that anymore.
Yeah, I mean, that's it, because you're right, because a lot of the old worries revolved around what do they think of me? They must think I'm stupid. They must think I don't know what I'm talking about. And there's so much unnecessary, almost irrational beliefs, because you'll never know what they think.
Right.
But it doesn't really matter what they think.
Right.
Really.
Right.
And for the most part, most people are actually okay with stuttering. That was one of the singularly most liberating things I ever discovered, was that most people don't really care.
Right, right.
Yeah, that's it. They like you. If they want to be with you, they will be with you. They don't care that you stutter. And sometimes they quite like it, you know, because it's part of the person that they, you know, person that they know and love, probably without having a stutter, if that makes sense.
Right. But yeah, that does make sense, because that stutter is part of you, that you present it to them and to the world. You know, and I think part of this, at least for me, I was always afraid, and I think this is a basic fear, I was always afraid of rejection. You know, I was afraid that the person is going to judge me in some way and I would be rejected. And I think that's very real, you know, among everybody, not just people who stutter. You know, we want to be liked, we want to belong. So in winding down, and it's funny how these conversations always go so quickly, what advice might you offer a younger woman who is just starting out on her journey with either accepting stuttering or, you know, being able to begin talking about it?
Probably the first thing I would say would be just be you. Be just take stock
have a think about what makes you you, what makes you happy, what pleases you, what you like to do within reason, and just accept those flaws, accept how you feel about them, but don't necessarily rest back on them. There's always something that, you know, it's not inevitable that, you know, at the saddest moment, it's not inevitable that you will always feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always something to look forward to.
Yeah.
And rise to a challenge. Yeah.
Excellent insight and very inspiring for other people that are going to hear this. And your whole story, Leslie, let me just say thank you so much for being a guest and being so honest. People that listen to this are going to be very inspired by you.
Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity. It's been wonderful to meet you properly, albeit like this.
Yes.
And it's absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you again. Mm-hmm. And this has been Women Who Stutter, Our Stories.